an adult human being is supposed to, at rest, take 10 or 12 breaths a minute. And some of the meditative traditions, they try to teach adults at rest to get it to more like 6 breaths per minute. If trouble, anxiety, worry, fears were something that the rest of us, we could see it. When we looked at you, we could see it. What would it look like? What would you look like? Some of you, if it were a weight, or if it were a certain burden that you carry, maybe it was the kind of clothes that you wore when you were feeling fearful or anxious, maybe it was just layers of clothes, we'd be able to go, whoa, look what they drug in here. What would it look like? But we can't tell. Who knows but you, and maybe not even you anymore, you're so used to it, what you've actually brought into this room with regard to trouble, your worry, your fear, your anxieties. Some of you, you've already excluded yourself from what I'm talking about because you're like, I don't have any fears right now. I'm good. But what a lot of people are finding that are interested in the research is that a lot of us adults are walking around panting 22, 25 breaths a minute at rest. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to just take a couple breaths with you this morning, and we're going to breathe, and some of you are like, that sounds pretty Eastern. Jesus preached in Palestine, so you can unpucker. That's east of here. But will you join me in actually sitting and breathing as an act of worship for just a moment? Just fill your lungs. Some of you are like, how could I only do 6 of those in a minute? I'm already turning purple. Maybe that should alert you. Oh, I'm not scared. I don't have any anxieties. I'm good. How's your breathing? John chapter 6, fourth book of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. If you go to Acts, you're too far. If you have a Bible, crack it open in the New Testament, fourth book, book of John. It reads this way, chapter 6, verse 1. After this, everything that's been detailed in the previous 5 chapters, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. John has detailed this kind of thing up to this point, to the point that by chapter 6, Jesus has a reputation. There are people that nobody else would listen to. Nobody else would even speak to him. If they did speak to him, they just said, hey, the reason you're sick is because you're a sinner. The reason you're an outcast, that you're isolated, that blah, 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 you don't have blessing of God, is because you're a sinner. You're on the outside of God's love. But Jesus seems to speak to people no one else will speak to. He's a voice for the voiceless, and he's actually helping people in their innermost world as well as their physical ailments. Jesus seems to be providing hope to people who previously didn't have any hope. And so obviously he's got a reputation for this. And so they're following him because they see the signs that he's doing on the sick. And Jesus went up on the mountain and there he sat down with his disciples. Now, when you think mountain, Jesus doesn't have like a pocket full of carabiners. He's going rappelling. This isn't a snow-capped peak. A mountain in Galilee are these huge rolling hills. Okay, so get this image in your head that Jesus goes up on this huge rolling hillside, and there he sits down with his disciples, his learners. Now, the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And lifting up his eyes, Jesus looks up then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus says to Philip, hey, Phil, where are we going to buy bread so these people can eat? Now, we're going to find out here in a few verses that there are thousands of people coming. It says that there are 5,000 men. Now, in the old world, man, you could say man generically, and you'd be talking about men and women. Oh, that's so barbaric. Well, I hear women all the time say, hey, guys, to their girlfriends. So we still do it. So What I want you to understand is that this isn't just a small troop of people. It says there are 5,000 men, which might mean that there are as many as 15,000 people when you include the women and the children. Who knows? But it's thousands of people, and you can hear their feet, and you can hear things bouncing together. You can hear somebody brought their dog, and you can hear kids, and this roar of people coming. And Jesus looks over and says, "Hey, Philip, where are we going to buy bread to feed all of these people?" How would you hear that question? What? What are you talking about? And he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. And Philip answered him, 200 denarii. A denarii is about a day's wages. 200 days' wages wouldn't buy enough bread for each of them to have a snack, Jesus. Over half a year's work, if you took all of that money, and that's a good paying job, all of that money would not do the trick. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" These people are coming up the hill, and what is the tone of the disciples? It's sarcasm. They have an edge to them. Jesus wants to see how they're going to handle the situation. But maybe more to the point, Jesus wants them to see how they're going to handle the situation. You know why? There's always people coming up the hill, aren't there? You know what you're facing tomorrow. Whether you go away to work or whether your job is to take care of children or you're going back to school tomorrow, there's a whole mess of people climbing your hill. What are you going to do? They have expectations. So does Jesus. What are you going to do? See, they're standing there with Jesus, but what do? They immediately go into, "Well, I guess this is all up to me" mode. And you have sarcasm. There's an edge. There's a worry. There's an anxiety present. But at the same time, you've got people coming up the hill going, "I wonder if my needs are going to be met." So you got people on top of the hill saying, "I'm going to fail Jesus. I'm going to fail these people." And you got people coming up the hill going, "I wonder if he's going to fail me. I wonder if Jesus is going to fail me. I wonder if the people are going to fail me." There's an anxiety present. There's a tension. There's a worry in the air. Philip immediately starts calculating. He gets out his little abacus, and he's like, this is never going to work. What are you talking about? This is never going to work, feeding these people. Andrew starts working the crowd, apparently. They're coming up. He goes down. "What do you got? What do you got? What do you got? Hey, this kid's got fish and chips. I know that's not going to do anything, but it's letting you know, the kid. That's all." And that woman's got a granola bar. "But what's this going to do, Jesus, for so many?" What are they not doing? They're not asking Jesus for help. They're telling Jesus that it's not possible. Isn't it funny how loud fear, anxiety, worry screams? They're standing with Jesus, and they don't ask him for help. But see, we're blessed with being able to look back through history, back through the cross, all the way like, "Man, why didn't you just say, Jesus, fix this? This is going to be good." Because just the chapter before, there was a paralyzed guy, paralyzed his whole life, and Jesus on the Sabbath said, "Dude, get up, roll your mat up, put it under your arm, go home." Everybody knew it wasn't a hoax. This guy's been paralyzed his whole life. Now he's walking home with his bed under his arm. Before that, the nobleman's son, "My son's got this fever. He's on the verge of dying." And Jesus goes, "Nope." Goes and asks his servant, "Is he well?" "Yeah, he's been well since," and gives him the exact hour that proved Jesus had healed him remotely. Before that, the first recorded miracle in John at Cana, the wedding, they ran out of wine. This huge insult to the guests. "I didn't plan very well." And so Jesus takes 6 big things of water, and suddenly they become wine, and it was good stuff. Like, these guys are like, "Man, he busted out the good wine at the end. Like, the boxed thing, I thought that would make sense. This is good wine." They've seen all of this, and they're standing on this hillside going, "Jesus, let me explain to you some simple math. Whole bunch of them, 2 fish. It's not going to happen." What are they not doing? They're not asking Jesus for help, because anxiety and fear and worry scream louder than God. If you listen, there's a way of standing in front of Jesus and not being present. "Well, these guys just didn't believe in Jesus." No, he was standing there. But they had already determined what's possible, and they start worrying, and they're standing in front of Jesus, and they're not present at all. They're figuring, they're calculating the next 6 months' wages, what that might do, and they're talking to the problem, They're talking to the children to see what they have. They haven't asked Jesus a single question. They're making statements. Look at Luke chapter 10. As they went on their way, Jesus entered a village. He's got his entourage with him. A woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet. The word sat is reclined. She's on an elbow, reclined at Jesus' feet, listening to his teaching. But Martha was distracted. I like that word, distraction. You lose your footing. Distracted with much serving. Another translation says, was distracted by preparations, pre-parations. And she went up to him and said, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to serve, to prepare alone? Tell her to help me. But the Lord answered, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled. You are worried and fearful about many things, but really only one thing's necessary. Mary's chosen the good portion. I'm not going to take that from her. But Jesus, I'm preparing. I'm doing all the work. Yeah, but Mary's not going to miss the moment. Prepare. You're getting ready for something that hasn't happened yet. Your mind is completely fixated on not right now. Because you don't want to disappoint some standard, or you don't want to repeat some past embarrassment when you weren't prepared, or you're trying to make sure that the future plays itself out just right, and as a result, you're not here. Your body is. But you're not. Your sister is. She's made a really wise choice. See, Martha's not doing anything evil. She's just not there. Everybody else would say, no, she's right there. And Jesus would say, mm-mm, that's just her shell. She's some other time. There's a way of standing in front of people and even standing in the presence of Jesus, but anxiety, fear, and worry actually abduct you from the moment. They actually take you away from the moment. And here's the bad news about that. God is a God of right now. Yes, he's the God of our traditions and of everything that's gone wrong in the past. Yes, he's the God of the future and the hope that we have, but his interactive presence is right now. You cannot live in the past. You cannot live in the future. You weren't made to. God is the God of this moment. And if you're not here, you're not interacting with God. That's the bad news. A couple weeks ago, I was doing something that I've done very often, but I finally thought about it, what I was actually doing for really the first time. Cheese samples. I'm big on cheese samples. Go to Kroger, Whole Foods. They sometimes calculate this just right. So I think they capitalize on what the cheese sample is supposed to be, an advertisement for the cheese. And so this is one of my favorite times of the week when the cheese samples go out. And so I'm trying to back off of the amount of cheese that goes in my face. And I'm going to say I like cheese, but really that language isn't strong enough. It's creepier than that. I just really, really like cheese. And so cheese samples, these free samples, are very important to me. And so what I do is I walk by and I grab the complimentary toothpick and I stab it through the little square of cheese and I look up and I stab it through a second and third and I pack it in my mouth and I start chewing. But here's what I realize that I do in that same moment. I grab the wedge of cheese and I flip it over and I start reading the ingredients and I start reading where it was made, because that's important for cheese. And I'm reading through and then I look at the price. But here's the funny thing. I've never, and I mean this, never purchased cheese represented by a free sample. Never, ever. I go back and buy the yellow brick. That's my budget. This, you pick up this little wedge, oh, $26. That makes sense. I guess it comes with a gem. But what I do is I very thoughtfully, I read the cheese and I cock my head to the side. I even give the beard a stroke while I'm chewing. Why? Because I don't want someone to look at me and think I'm some monkey trying to pack my face full of cheese. But I'm a monkey packing my face full of cheese. That's the only reason I'm standing there. I'm not there to shop or make the intelligent decision that my presentation would suggest that I'm trying to make. I just want free cheese, but I just don't want you to know that I just want free cheese. Now, when I'm eating cheese, trying to conceal that my cheeks are so packed that my eyes are actually pulling down, and I'm thinking about how you are perceiving me, complete strangers, what am I not enjoying? Cheese. The very thing I'm trying to accomplish is being hijacked by my fear that you're going to find out what I'm trying to accomplish. My palms don't sweat during that moment. I'm not all shaky. What are people going to think? It's just I have this small voice in my head that says, don't let people think less of you. Don't let people get the wrong idea of you. Complete strangers actually abducts me from the moment, and I'm chewing, and the calories are staying, but the enjoyment of it, gone. Because fear of how I'm being perceived completely takes me out of that moment. How many people in this room don't know how to do friendships? They have a fear, an anxiety, a worry that they're not good at friendships, they're not good at relationships. And man, once I talk to somebody the first, second, third time, whatever, news, weather, sports, blank. I don't know what to do when you're not triangulating off of superficiality. And so I get worried. Do they think I'm weird? I wonder if they like me yet. I wonder if they like how I look. And some of the adults in here is like, man, what a basket case. We all do this in our different words. We're all, geez, how am I being received? Are they impressed with me? Boy, that sounded stupid. I wish I hadn't said that. And our worry about being bad relationally makes us a little bit awkward, which feeds into our worst fear. We actually become bad at the thing that we're fearing we're bad at by worrying about being bad at it. We can't be present in the moment and just enjoy the company of another human being made in the image of God. I don't know what to say, and I don't know how I'm being heard. And what, geez, it got quiet there for a second. Awkward silence. You know, we can't have dead air. This isn't a radio program. Well, if we're not talking, and geez, that's kind of weird. Who wants to hang out with people that can't stand silence? Not me would be one answer. And this tension, this worry, how am I being perceived? How am I being heard? Did I say the right? And this, I can't be present in that moment. Oh, I'm just an introvert. No, you're not, probably. You're probably just terrified of people, and you don't even realize how much tension there is relationally because you don't know how to feel. How many people in this room are lying about something central of importance in their life? You lie to your spouse. You lie to your kids, you lie to your parents, you lie to coworkers. It's this one thing, or maybe just a couple things. It's not everything. Very, very rare that you find somebody that lies about everything. But it's this one thing. And no matter how many times it's preached on, no matter how many times you get a special speaker that comes to church or a seminar you go to or books that you read or just the Holy Spirit through comments or emails poking you in the ribs, hey, when are you going to deal with this? You continue to hide it, which means you walk into every single relational scenario going, I can't let you know me. And so you're guarding this thing that happened in the past, or you're guarding this thing that you hope doesn't happen in the future, maybe being found out about the thing in the past, and I'm spending all my time trying to get inside your head to see how you perceive me living in the past and in the future. You're not here. You're not present because you're not made to live in another time or in somebody else's skull, and you're not present because you're afraid. How many people cannot enjoy something good, something pleasurable? They feel guilty about it. I can't spend that much on that dress for that. I can't have a nice dinner with my whoever. I can't go there. I can't take the kids there. I can't blah, 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 blah. You can't give me this. You can't enjoy good things in a broad sense because somehow you've decided that you're not worthy of those kinds of things. You feel like a fraud. You feel like, well, if I accept this, it's me saying, yes, I'm worth it. And I don't want people to think I'm arrogant or cocky. And so, no, this false humility, no, I'm not worth that. Or more significantly, you believe that God only smiles on suffering. And if I'm enjoying this while there are starving kids in Ethiopia, geez, this is all wrong. And so you never know how to feel about something good. You never know how to feel about something pleasurable and good and beautiful. And so you're never present in it. Everybody else seems to be having a good time, and you're racked with guilt and shame and anger, and you struggle with, should I judge them for what they're enjoying? Don't they know? But man, I would really like to just enjoy it if I'm being honest. And you don't know how to feel. And so you know what? You're not there. You don't know how to feel about it, and so you're not present. And if you're not present, you're not interacting with the God of now. You cannot mix fear and faith. Fear abducts you from this present moment. Faith, afforded to us by Jesus Christ, his sacrifice, his love, swung open a door that was locked from the other side. We could not just be our train wreck selves and then expect to live without consequence in the presence of absolute perfect beauty. And Jesus bridges that gap. Faith is about living in the presence of God interactively right now in every single thing that you do. It changes your entire, it doesn't mean, oh, now I go to church. It means every moment I'm living interactively in the presence of God. Faith is about the presence of God right now, and then right now, and then right now. Fear takes you from the presence of God because it makes you think that you're doing something good by dealing with the past or the future or somebody else's head. That's why faith and fear don't mix. It's not because it's a game. It's not a word game. It's that they're totally different ways of living, if you can call living and fear living, because you're not made to be omnipresent. You're not made to live. You can't live in the past. You can't live in the future. You're made to live right now, but fear won't let you. Worry doesn't let you. I'm fascinated that anxiety is the state of being anxious. It's the same word, and it comes from the same root word as anger, which means to restrict or to strangle, to narrow. The word worry comes from a totally different word, but it means to strangle. In the mid-1500s, the Germans started using the word from which we get our word worry. And it actually means, in terms of a dog or a wolf, harassing sheep. Worry, anger, anxiety, anxiousness, it strangles you. Man, no wonder we walk around panting. How do I deal with what I regret? How do I make sure good things happen and nothing bad happens to me anymore? And how are you seeing me? And I miss out on right now, the only place I'm designed to live. That's where God is. This moment has been saved for my enjoyment. But I'm not here. I'm worrying about things I have no business taking responsibility for. Which brings us to Psalm 23. We're in the second week of this series. Verse 1, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Verse 2, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still, quiet, calm, peaceful waters. A literal translation says that he causes me. He doesn't force you. He doesn't sweep the leg. He causes me to lie down in green pastures. Now, the word green really isn't there in Hebrew. It's tender grass. The green is implied. But the literal translation is that he causes me to lie down in tender grass. And you got to remember, this whole psalm is written from the perspective of a sheep. So, from a sheep's perspective, what this is saying is, my shepherd causes me to lie down in dinner. Why wouldn't dinner cause me to lie down? I mean, from a sheep's perspective, it seems like the best tender grass, easy to digest, it's good. Why doesn't the grass cause me to lie down? Fear. You ever hang out with animals? Man, they can, I'm not talking to your parents. Man, animals can be really uptight. They like to eat on the go. Always looking over their shoulder. When am I going to have to flee? When am I going to have to fight? Ah, but the shepherd's here, and he just lets me lie down in green, tender grass. Ah. So it occurs to me, it's very hard for me to get away right now. It'd be hard for me to run, to flee. But at the same time, it'd be really hard to fight right now. Like if you're a wrestler and this is how you fight, you might want to try tennis. Suddenly, I'm laying in a blessing. I mean, why doesn't the tender grass make me want to sit down? Well, because that's how loud fear and anxiety can scream. They can actually scream over pleasure. You'll actually deny good things because of how loud fear and worry will scream. Sometimes God has to get involved. Yeah, it's God, my shepherd, that causes me to enjoy good things. And so here, I'm kind of vulnerable. This is a position of trust. This is a position of confidence that I think I'm going to be okay. But more than anything, this is about, I'm right here. I mean, I'm fully present. I can't go anywhere. I can't run. I can't fight. I'm fully present in blessing. There's really not much I can do. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He causes me to lie down and be blessed. He leads me beside the waters of peace. Now, this is one of my favorite things. John chapter 6, we've just talked about it. They've got this whole herd of people coming up. They've got all these expectations. What are we going to do? Jesus, don't you understand what you're trying to do is impossible? And all these people, hey, this is our last ticket out of Hungry Town. And all these expectations, these two groups of people coming together, you can hear their feet. I don't know if you've heard thousands of people walk, but it makes noise. And so you can hear these people coming up the hill. And Andrew has just said, listen, This kid, he's got some fish and some bread, but what's that going to be for so many? And maybe there were some other comments. Maybe there's some other head scratching, but nobody's asking Jesus for help. And then Jesus speaks, verse 10. Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now the word sit, same word as in Luke 10, where Mary's sitting at the feet of Jesus. It's recline. It's lay down. Have the people lie down. And John adds this line. There was plenty of grass in that place. And the men sat down. Wait, John, what? Why is it important that we find out there's plenty of grass in the place? He doesn't go back to this. He doesn't reference it again. He doesn't make any more points about it. Just, he wants a picture in your head. There's plenty of grass in the place. And the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. And Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, distributed to those who were reclined. Huh. What about the people who are still pacing? My kids, where are they going to go to college? Jesus, does the lad have two degrees in his little basket that you can multiply for my kids? I mean, where am I going to get this? And what about Thanksgiving? Do you recognize that the whole family is going to converge on my house on Thanksgiving? I got to get the house ready. I've got to. And what about this? And Jesus, blah 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 blah. And what about the future? And what about the past? And geez, how are all these people seeing me? How do I compare to some of these other people that you're talking to? And he gives the bread to those who are laying down, because that's kind of a statement of, you lead. I'm terrible at this. He did the same with the fish, much as they wanted. If you'll recline, because I will not throw food at you while you're running by trying to save your universe. I am the shepherd. I am God. I am the Lord. You're terrible at it. Lay down. And if you do, as much as you want, I'm going to take care of you. It might come differently than you expect. It might not line up with your grand genius scheme, but you're going to be just fine. Lay down. Breathe. But I'm feeling strangled. Yeah, that's fear. That's anger. That's anxiety. That's worry. You weren't made to do any of those things for very long. Yeah, sometimes it keeps you alive. I want you to worry if a wild beast runs in the room. Worry will keep you alive. But what you've turned everything into a threat. You've turned everything into a wild beast. Listen to you panting. Why don't you lay down, catch your breath, and let me lead, says Jesus. On another grassy hill, in another chapter 6, Matthew chapter 6, he's preaching the Sermon on the Mount. And all of these people are listening on this grassy hillside. And he goes through what it means to live in the kingdom, a kingdom of living right now in this moment. Taking responsibility for the things that you broke in the past, taking responsibility for things that are yet to come, taking responsibility for your brothers and your sisters, but living right now, because right now dictates your efficiency for all those other things. This kingdom of God message that he gives, this is what the proper way to interact with each other and to interact with God based on what Jesus alone does for us. And he gets to chapter 6 and he starts making these statements. Chapter 6 is really, really, really heavy. It starts off in verse 1. He says this, be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. Next verse. So when you give to the needy, these acts of righteousness, when you actually live in generosity, don't announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by men. He says, so in everything that I'm telling you, to participate in this faith, don't tap dance for people. Don't make this one more way that you try to control how you're perceived. Don't try to look like you're going to buy the cheese. Just be honest or you're going to miss what generosity is actually for. This isn't about adding to your repertoire spiritually. Just be generous. Trust me. Yeah, but I just want people to know that I'm really generous. Not to mention humble. Next verse. Verse 5. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites. They love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. These big, loud, announcement-type prayers where while you're praying, you're actually gossiping about people. While you're praying, you're actually preaching a sermon. It sounds like you're supposed to believe I'm talking to God, but you're actually preaching a sermon to everybody listening. Listen to all these big words and listen to all my theology. And Jesus says, stop it. God's not impressed. And you're using prayer as something to control how people perceive you, which means you're not here. You're trying to get inside of other people's heads. Just pray. He goes on to say, just go in private and go pray. If you're praying, just go pray privately. Next verse, 16. When you fast, don't look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they're fasting. Oh, if you had any idea how spiritual I am. I skipped breakfast. I love him. That's why. You're right. I'm thinking about skipping lunch or pushing it back to 1. I go to second hour. I love Jesus. He says, stop it. You're totally nullifying the fast because you're using it to add to your own arsenal of why you're better than all the other people on this pilgrimage. Stop it. You're not living your life right now. You're trying to live in this other realm. Because you fear and you're anxious and you're worried about how you're being perceived. Next verse. Don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, but where thieves break in and steal. Don't hoard, but I want people to know how impressive I am. I want them to respect me for, you know, how many chariots and camels and stuff that I have in my garage. And yet, stop it. You're living in somebody else's skull. You're trying to live in the future. You're trying to outrun your past or your parents' past because they didn't have what you always thought you should have to really live life. Stop it. You've missed the point of having resources in the first place to enjoy them and make sure other people can enjoy them as well. Stop it. Next. He sums up this whole piece this way. Therefore, based on everything I've just told you, don't worry about your life. What you're going to eat or drink or your body, what you're going to wear. Isn't life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They don't sow or reap and store away in barns. But your heavenly Father seems to treat them okay. They're fed. Aren't you much more valuable than birds? Who of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? The literal Greek is who can make yourself taller? I love that. Who by worrying can make yourself a cubit taller? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow? They don't labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. Wait. What are we talking about Solomon and splendor? Because you're thinking, oh, this is a barbaric, poor society. When he mentions clothes, he's talking about protecting yourself from the elements. No. It's nothing less than that, but he's talking about fashion. That's how relevant the Bible is. 2,000 years ago, people were walking, if you can imagine, 2,000 years ago, people were walking around, I wonder if these pants make my butt look big. 2,000 years ago, I wonder if you can tell by my robe how wealthy I am. I wonder if you can tell by my headdress that I should be sitting up front. See, it's not just practicalities. It's this game we play. I wonder if they think I'm going to buy the cheese. If that's how God clothes grass of the field, which is here today and then tomorrow is thrown into the fire so he can cook food, how much more is he going to clothe you? You have little faith. You have little presence. Don't worry saying, what are we going to eat? What are we going to drink? What are we going to wear? For the pagans, the words Gentiles, people who don't know who God is, they run after these things. They spend their life pursuing those things. Your heavenly Father knows that you need them. Seek first his kingdom, the very present kingdom, and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, don't worry about tomorrow. What are you talking about? We haven't mentioned tomorrow. We're talking about don't worry about your life. Don't worry about clothes and food and drink. But suddenly Jesus connects it to, here's the issue, is you're trying to control things that haven't happened yet. They're in the future where you can't take responsibility for things that haven't happened yet. You can be responsible so that you don't ruin your life, but you're worrying about tomorrow. Don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. How many different places are you right now? Even after this message, you're sitting here and you're wondering, well, when is this over and what am I going to get my kids for lunch? And some of you, not because you're evil, but you're already thinking about your presentation this week because it's a big one. So right now you're trying to live in Wednesday. How many of us are sitting here right now and we realize that the issue isn't, I've got this big event coming where the people coming up the hill and there's going to be this event. It's this constant looking over my shoulder, recognizing there's about 5,000 people who have an expectation that I be attractive, that I be smart, that I be right. How many of us are sitting here right now and they're worried about the God of tomorrow? If I don't get my theology correct, then the God of tomorrow, the God of after I die, is going to punish me. I think I'm out. What do I have to do to fix my past so that my future can be fixed? And God is sitting in front of you right now going, my dear son, my dear daughter, I'm right here. You weren't made to live then. You weren't made to live then. And I'm not one of these people you need to get inside their skull to try to manipulate how they see you. The Lord, your shepherd, is your companion. Lie down. How many different places do you live in any given moment? Because if it's more than where you're sitting now, you're not living. And I mean that with respect, but I mean it very literally. You're not made to take responsibility emotionally for things that haven't happened and have already happened, and you can't take responsibility for other people's perception. You can't live there. You can't do that. You weren't made to. And so in memorizing the psalm during this series, it's one more way that we're working really, really hard to remind ourselves to do better than the disciples did on that hill. That I want some of my first questions when trouble comes, I want one of my first questions not to be, how do I get out of this? How do I run from this? Or how do I fight this? How do I win this? But to lay down in the grass and go, all right, Jesus, what are you going to do? And how can I be part of it? Because if we're laying down, we have to ask some serious questions about what we think about faith. Because, geez, it's not being spiritual means forget the past. We'd be lying if we forgot what happened to us and things that we caused. And it can't mean take no responsibility for the future. Yeah, the more faith you have, the less you work on retirement. You don't save money. You don't think about tomorrow. It just blah, blah, blah. I'm spiritual. It can't be that. And it can't be apathy to other people all around me right now. Well, they're doing their thing, but me, I'm just kind of laying in the tender grass with the Lord, and you all worry about your thing. I'm at peace. It can't be that. So, wait a minute. If the Lord is my shepherd, and I shall not want, and he causes me to lie down, well then, what's it mean, and who causes me to get up? Well, that's next Sunday. Let's just do today. See you next week.